Teresa Saldana co-starred in the film Raging Bull, which was directed by Martin Scorsese and starred Robert De Niro in the role of fighter Jake LaMotta. Saldana played LaMotta's sister-in-law. After the release of the movie, a deranged fan tracked Saldana down and stabbed her repeatedly outside her California apartment. Neighbors watched as she screamed, but they neither came to her aid nor called the police. Finally, the assailant was tackled by a delivery man. Saldana miraculously survived after 5 operations. When she came out of intensive care, she was overcome by fear and depression. Although her family was constantly at her side and very helpful, she felt they didn't really understand what she was feeling. Out of her desire to discuss her emotions with other victims of violent crime, she co-founded the self-help group Victims for Victims. Victims for Victims is also the name of the movie about Saldana, which will be broadcast on NBC Monday evening. In Philadelphia, you can see it on Channel 3. It dramatizes the period of her life from the attack to the creation of Victims for Victims. Saldana's acting credits include roles in the films Nunzio, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Defiance, and The Evil That Men Do. She's currently performing in Philadelphia in the Walnut Street Theater production of Chekhov and Yalta. That's at the Walnut Street Theater through November 18th, and for ticket information, you can call 574-3586. That's 574-3586. Teresa Saldana, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
How soon after this terrible thing happened to you did you start getting offers to have a movie made about your life?
Well, just a few days after getting out of intensive care, I received the first offer, and all I did was laugh at it. It was unbelievable. I remember it was an offer, $5,000 for worldwide exclusive rights for the entire story of my life into infinity. I said, no, even if I'm very ill, even I know enough to take this and throw it away. It was really ridiculous. And it was by someone I'd never heard of and some independent person, I guess. I just threw the paper away. And after that, there were a number of other offers of varying degrees of seriousness coming along. And within a week of the attack, I knew that there would be a movie made about what had happened, that it had been so public, particularly in L.A., that there was no way around it. The only real question was, would it be the true story? Would I be involved? Or would I just sit back and allow someone to possibly fictionalize it, change the names, and do whatever they wanted to with the story? I really wanted to avoid that at all costs.
How long did it take you after the attack to start seriously thinking about what your options were and which you were going to take?
Well, in terms of...
When did you start to care about this stuff again?
I cared about acting from the beginning, because that was not this movie per se. I cared about getting back to work, getting better, getting out of the hospital. Those were the things that I cared about. I needed to feel that I could return to a functioning, normal existence. I did not want to be crippled. I didn't want to be an invalid forever. And so the motivating force was the ability to go back to work. I wanted to recover and get back to work and show people who were now seeing me in pictures in a wheelchair, in braces, looking terrible, looking ill and devastated. I wanted to show people in the industry and those at home that I was going to overcome this horrible thing and not let this deranged person ruin my life forever. I did not want to be destroyed by him. And I was lucky enough to have had Jeff Fenn rescue me, and I darn well wanted to prove that I could get back to a full recovery. And so the question was really going back to acting. And then as the months went by and different serious offers came in, I weighed the offers in terms of the movie. But I knew then, as became the case, that it would take a while to get the movie going. And I assumed that by the time the project would be shot, I'd be well enough to do it myself. And from the very beginning, my thought in mind was always, yes, I will someday give the rights to someone who wants to do this story well, but it will be with the consideration that I must play myself and must be a technical advisor. So,
why'd you want to play yourself? Because I could see having the opposite reaction, too, that, you know, it was terrible enough to live through it, to have to act it again over and over again so that you could do different takes of it is more than a lot of people, I think, could emotionally put themselves through.
Well, in the beginning, when thinking about it, the most important thing to me was to depict everything as it really was, to make it as realistic as humanly possible. And I was in such shock about what a victim goes through. I just could not believe that there was so little financial support, so little emotional support, and so little concern on the part of the system for a victim of crime. I had this mistaken belief, as most people do, before being attacked, that if something happened to me, I was a law-abiding citizen, minding my own business, a good taxpayer, etc., that the government would take care of me, that someone would take care of me. And that wasn't the case. And as I learned this more and more, and the weeks and months went by, I really developed a need to want to tell people, not just about my story, but about the situation. And I felt that the best way to do it was to play myself, because I really went through it. And I thought, wow, that would be one step removed already if I involve an actress and sit and coach another person to play me. They'd have to worry more about being the character than about the real situation. I didn't have to worry about a characterization. What I had to concern myself with was depicting the events and lending the emotion to the events that was required.
Did the network, when they decided to do the movie, give you any tests to see if you could psychologically hold up under the pressure?
They didn't give me any tests, but no one was very thrilled with my insistence upon playing myself. No one was thrilled with that, and there was quite a period of time when my manager, Selma Rubin, who's a fantastic woman, just said, no, there is no story without the girl. Teresa will play herself, and we will not discuss this matter. No, we don't want a little clause. We don't want anything. This is her story. It happened to her, and she wants to do it, and you owe it to her, if you want her story, to let the actress play herself. This is an actress. It's not like I was just a person attacked who wanted to play herself. That would be different. But I'm a union member, and I'm a working professional. And if it happened to me and they wanted the story, then I wanted to play it. And what happened was really interesting. In the beginning, there was a lot of concern. In fact, they insisted that I shoot the attack scene last because they were worried. People didn't know me personally. Maybe they had gone to a few lunches or meetings with me, but they didn't know me personally. Those who did, my friends, my family, anyone who knew me on any level of intimacy at all, realized that doing the movie would be good for me and that I was able to do it, equipped to do it, and that somehow it would work out and that it wouldn't be upsetting. However, people who didn't know me were really concerned, including the producers, that I would flip out, that I would emotionally break down, that I would be unable to distinguish between the film and reality. And it was a lot of verbal agreement. I just kept saying, I will do it, I will prove it to you, you will see, don't worry. And they were at least understanding enough. Once they agreed to it and once we made an actual deal, they began to take a positive attitude too. No one was completely convinced, but they realized that that I was being strong about it, and they started meeting with me a number of times, and people began to think, well, okay. But they asked, did I want a psychiatrist on the set? And things like that. So on the first day of shooting, my shooting, there was one day that went by, and I wasn't involved in that. From the second day on, I was in every day, almost every minute. And there I was, and all the eyes were upon me, the producers, the director, the crew, the other cast members, and the looks in their eyes. Everyone was very concerned. People thought, uh-oh, this is going to be a bizarre movie, or uh-oh, she's got an emotional scene. Maybe she's not going to return from that emotion. And what really happened was both the first and second days, we shot a lot of very difficult material. And in between takes, interestingly, I usually keep up the emotion if I can in between takes so that I don't have to work it up again the second, third, fourth time. And later on, when I finished one of these difficult scenes, my makeup man said, you better go talk to the producer. He's worried because he saw that you keep crying in between the nightmare scene. And I went up to the producer, and the producer was thinking about even bringing in a psychiatrist. And I said, don't worry, I'm just acting. And I went and literally danced down the hall in my hospital robe with my fake IV pole attached to me, because I really wanted to show them that I was acting and that they didn't have to worry, even if it was emotional. And within, I'd say, 1 to 2 days, the ice was broken and everyone made a big jump, a big, wonderful transition from this is a weird movie to this is a special movie. And from the grips, cameramen, electricians on up, everyone really pulled together and did a remarkable job, worked very quickly, very hard, and intensively, and had a lot more concern on this project than I think you'd normally get, because they made that choice and they made that transition from the thought of it as weird to the thought of it as special. And they knew this was really the life story. This was really someone's true story. And they came to know me as a person, and they were terrific. I had a very pleasant creative experience on that project.
Were there times when your director said, oh no, you should really look this way, you should play it that way, and you had to say, but it wasn't like that, it was like this, and you'd go back and forth?
I had a woman director, Karen Arthur. She was fantastic. The woman is great. Anyway, just as a regular director, but in this, she respected my judgment. Occasionally, she would express an opinion, pull me aside, but we never were in conflict. It was really a situation of luck in a way, and it was kind of a blessing. It was almost like somebody was watching out for me, because the screenwriter is fantastic. He has a lot of integrity, and he wrote the movie out of tapes that I made, based really directly on the tapes. The director was very compassionate, very sensitive. The producers had lots of integrity, and they were really supportive and sharp enough to listen to my advice as technical advisor. People didn't try to cross me, and therefore I never had to be demanding, ever. It was a matter of they would come to me and say, how was this? I would tell them. Sometimes I had pictures, photographs to show, or they would interview other people. They did lots of wonderful research in advance, pre-production, and the consideration and care they put into this film is just commendable. You know, you would think, oh, it was my life story and I would have some horror story about being abused by the network. But I have to say it was exactly the opposite.
I'm glad to hear it. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with actress Teresa Saldana, who stars in a movie about a portion of her own life. The movie's called Victims for Victims. And it's about the part of her life after the production of Raging Bull, when she was attacked and stabbed repeatedly, to the period after her recovery when she founded a self-help group called Victims for Victims, and it will be shown on NBC television this Monday evening at 9 o'clock. Can I ask you what it was like during that scene when you were stabbed in the movie? Because I just can't imagine what was going through your mind when it was restaged in front of cameras.
It was not the most difficult scene, by any means. The more difficult scenes were really the feeling scenes, the emotional scenes of weakness and injury, that situation, the period in the film where I'm on that borderline of just having made it, the intensity of the reaction of the family scenes. Those scenes, because they really recalled images. You know, I never thought I was backwards in time, but they, of course, evoked memories, and it was very saddening. And we were really careful in between those scenes to perk things up and to be very jovial in between, get into a new costume and go right on with it. And I didn't let any kind of over-depression linger or anything like that. We would always snap right into another scene, and so there was never any lingering pain. I never had nightmares during production or anything like that. There was nothing, no residual feeling of depression, nothing like that. It was all very much acting. However, the attack scene was very choreographed, very, very choreographed. We did it the last day of production, and the only thing I seriously didn't like at all about it was the amount of prop blood that was used and needed. It was not pleasant to be covered with prop blood, because I don't like the sight of blood. I never did. And after this, you can imagine, I really don't like it. So that visual image I didn't like. But when we were shooting the attack scene, Philip English, who played the assailant, was very, very sensitive. He was not overly brutal or violent. We did only what was needed to portray the attack. We didn't get carried away and start acting like this was reality. There was no real force used. This was very staged. Very, very, very staged. It looks... You've seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening.
It scares me. Watching it, it scares me. But it was done by the numbers. And it was done exceedingly well. And not that many takes needed to be done, because we worked it out and talked it out first. And everyone was real careful. And everyone knew, look, this is not a pleasant scene for any of us. It wasn't pleasant to watch. It wasn't pleasant to film. Nothing about it was pleasant. But it was professional. And it was done. I did not have any thoughts in my mind about the actual attack when we were doing it. In my mind, the thoughts were 1, 2, fall, spin, turn, twist, scream, listen, run. So in my mind, really, underneath a lot of it was the actual mechanics of doing the scene. And of course, as any actress does, I was conjuring up an emotion that was appropriate to the scene. But I wasn't really imagining the actual attack.
I think what really impressed me most and kind of really froze me the most about that scene was your screaming.
Oh, I can't believe you said that.
The screaming, It was so, I knew that that's probably how you screamed when it happened. I mean, it's coming like from the upper throat. It's kind of constricted and almost animal-like. And I figured this is the real thing. This is how this is how it probably really was.
That's what makes the scene. You cannot show on television the graphic, horrendous reality of what that attack was like. No person could watch it. You wouldn't watch something like that unless you were forced. There's no way to visually depict it. Just no way. It was too horrible. But the screams were loud, and I think those screams are as horrible as the real screams. They chill me when I hear them. And those were gut-wrenching screams. They really were. I don't think you could get to a scream like that without the real knowledge of what that situation is like.
Have you ever had dreams, you know, like before you were attacked, that you were being attacked and you couldn't scream?
Oh, yeah, everybody has those. Occasionally that happens, but it's not that common. It's much more common. It's just a reaction to scream. I mean, not in pain and just for help, just to have someone, have somebody intervene. But this is a great story. The day of the attack, the day that the attack was shot, I knew I had to leave. I had to fly out of town. And another thing, that was a wonderful thing. I had another job to go to. And the day of the attack, we spent all day doing the attack. And at 8:15, I raced from the set, went to my trailer, washed off the prop blood, was driven to the airport, flew all night to New York, changed planes, flew to Connecticut, got off the plane at 8:30, went directly to the Eugene O'Neill Theater in Waterford, Connecticut, directly to rehearsals for Lisa and David, which is a musical version of Lisa and David, the original novel, which was subsequently made into a wonderful film with Cara Delevingne. And it was made into a musical. I had been in a number of backers auditions in New York in the past 6 months or so, and we were going to be doing it at the O'Neill. And I had to be there. I had to be there. And so I was there, and I flew all night right after doing the attack, and began the role of Lisa in Lisa and David. And that was wonderful, because there was no looking back. There was no sitting around. I wouldn't have wanted to go to Bermuda and lay in the sun and rest. I wouldn't have wanted to start mulling it over. What should I have done? Was it okay? Was this a smart choice? It was great. I went directly to another role, got into another person's head.
Kept the whole thing really professional.
Very. And there was never any leakage. There was never, I think if you're emotionally stable, look, I couldn't have done this movie 4 or 5 months after the attack. It would have made me crazy. But I am emotionally healed, and I'm also an actress. Most people, if they suffer a loss or a painful situation and they're performers, say they have a parent who dies, a child who's ill, a car accident, whatever, that situation, as horrible as it is, adds to your strength as an actor. And at some point, you may not use the actual experience, but you'll use the fact that you went through certain emotions and you're familiar with those emotions. That's how the movie was. I didn't deny the fact that I'd been through an attack or block it out of my mind. I had all those emotions to call upon as an actress, as I do now in any role. But there was never any slippage, what I call slippage. There was never any thought in my mind, uh-oh, I'm back in 1982. I knew I was 1984 and it was a movie.
Are you glad you shot it the last day?
No, it didn't matter either way. I would probably have preferred to shoot it first, but in retrospect, it doesn't matter because it worked. Whatever happened, it worked. And now looking at the piece, I'm just glad I did it. I've talked to people, some victims, groups, and service agencies are going to use it as a training tool. And I just think that combination of entertainment and artistic merit plus showing something with social value is unbeatable. And I really feel proud that I was a part of it and that I made the choice to play it myself. It would be so painful if I was watching someone else do it, not as an actress, just as a human being. I think the right choice, the victims who write to me, and that's before the airing now, people who've heard that I've done it, haven't seen it yet, are so supportive. And others who've been through tragedies are incredibly supportive about that choice.
How do you think your parents and your husband felt, though? Because they didn't have the opportunity to play themselves like you did.
Well, my parents wouldn't have wanted to. They haven't seen it yet. They will be seeing it Monday night along with the rest of the people who watch. They were real supportive about my doing the project, and they were supportive about the project itself. I think it's going to be very painful for my family to see this and for my ex-husband to see this. There's no doubt. This is going to be painful. It's more painful for me to watch this movie than it was to do it. The only thing that I like in terms of making myself watch it a number of times, it's like there are a lot of painful scenes, but what eventually happens is the spirit of the human being, in the end, somehow can surmount it. Because as you go through the movie, I, along with a lot of the audience, I think you just sit there and go, my God, how can this happen? And then after the attack, even the other problems that keep happening, it seems like it's almost too terrible for one human being to withstand. But if a person can withstand that, I think the human mind is much tougher than we think it is.
A couple of things I really wondered about watching the movie, like the neighbors who were watching you get attacked didn't do a thing. They were just standing there and talking. I assume that the depiction in the movie is about how it happened. Mm-hmm. When people are asked about revenge after an attack, I was thinking, well, gee, you might equally want revenge on your neighbors for having done nothing.
Well, look, all I can say is I don't judge them. Whatever they feel about their behavior is really what they have to answer to. I can't judge them. I don't know why they froze. Maybe some people were just utterly frozen, totally terrified, afraid they themselves would be stabbed. There has to be a reason. Look, I wish someone had jumped in sooner. The horrible, horrible injuries to my body would have been far less if someone had helped sooner. But I really don't give any time to thinking about it, about those people. They have to answer to themselves, not to me. I can't judge what they did. You know, it's painful to me. It's scary. But at the same time, I just release them, and that's their life. And I know at least one person who was there told a friend of mine that she cannot forget the screams, and she cannot forget that she didn't help. That was a very big woman, a very, very big lady who could have helped, who I knew. And I haven't seen her since or made effort to, but nor do I hate her in any way. It's just that I know from at least one point of view that she has suffered a lot since that day. She's had to go through a lot of anguish herself because she didn't help. She was just too scared.
Did you have any idea if you were going to live or not?
Oh, I didn't think I was going to live. No, I was in fact praying to die. I was in so much pain that I just...
It's amazing that you remain conscious, too. I kept thinking that when I was watching the movie, I can't believe she's conscious.
In fact, we couldn't really put in everything that was there because, in a way, it would have seemed bizarre or almost funny. Because when in the emergency room, for example, I said, please take out my lenses. Things like that really do happen, but they almost seem unbelievable. I had a whole running dialogue in the emergency room. By the emergency room, I had a little more hope. Right after the attack, I truly thought I would die. The pain was so intense, and the injuries were so unbelievable that no one could think that a human being could live. I mean, I didn't think even a big, huge person. I can't imagine that a human being could survive that. And I just immediately assumed, and I couldn't breathe. My lung was collapsed. I was in pain that even now I can't even begin to describe. And I was just thinking, let me go. I just wanted to go. And the good thing about it that it's done for me since, surviving this attack, is that it gave me a lot of courage about my own life. because when you're close to death, you really come face to face with who you are and how you've lived. And I had no fear of dying. I really didn't. I had no fear, no remorse. I felt very, very sad that I wouldn't see my parents or my sister, my family. I felt like a sense of detachment of why aren't they here? That was the only sadness I had. It wasn't that I wanted to die, but I was in a lot of pain, and I didn't have conflict about death, about a crossover. So it's really been remarkable for my life, because it's not a matter of conceit or vanity, like, oh, I'm just a great person now, I wasn't afraid to die. It's not like that. It's just, at least I feel that I'm on the right track. And like, you know how you always sit around going, oh, am I doing this right? Am I living my life correctly? Am I good enough or whatever? And it's just giving me a sense of, okay, I'm on the right track. And it leaves me free to do a lot more than I used to do, because I don't worry so much about what path I'm taking. I just go, trust it, it's okay, you know? And just being left here, the thing is about a horrible situation is you've got to take it one of two ways. You're only going to go down or you're going to go up. And if I sat around and thought about how horrible my situation was, and in a sense still is, because that person is still alive and still coming out of prison not too long from now, I would just commit suicide or go into a mental hospital. Because the pain, the thing is, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, she's an actress, she's fine now. And maybe after the movie they'll change their minds. But I think people see a recovered person, and it's a little hard to imagine the reality of the physical and mental devastation that existed. I was just absolutely a destroyed human being. A destroyed human being, both physically and mentally. And that situation was close to being unbearable in as a living person. Just untenable, not acceptable. Therefore, what do? You go mad or you kill yourself. And there was only one other choice after those two, and that was to live. And if you're going to pick life after that kind of situation, you can only live a life that's outrageous, that's really good, because otherwise, why bother?
So have you changed a lot of things in your life? You know, like the kind of house you live in or the kinds of things you do when you're not working?
Well, first of all, getting into victims' rights, that whole thing has changed my life. Because before, I was always an actress, and I loved helping people. I loved taking care of kids and sometimes working with older people, things like that. I loved doing things like that. But my primary focus was just basically on my career and that kind of thing. I was going to school. I did a lot of studying. Now I have this whole other element, which is Victims for Victims, the organization, and working in victims advocacy, helping other victims of crime, and being a spokesperson for victims in America, basically being a figurehead for other people who either don't want to or cannot speak up. So that kind of situation has really enriched my life. And it's not like I want to go into politics and just be a victims advocate or get some kind of position in Washington, which could be a possibility. I don't really want that. I need the two aspects of life now. And it's just really rewarding because working with people like this and having this kind of impact on society, helping to make change in the country, in society, is affecting my acting. It's making me just have so many different experiences and feeling so much freer. And I really look forward to acting work because I can change characters and put all of that painful situation, my pain and other people's pain, aside for a while and just be in a character, be in a show, be in a movie, and just have a great time and emotionally run through the course as an actress. Then, on the other hand, I don't think I'd feel fulfilled anymore just acting alone. Acting is what I do for a living full-time, and most of the time I'm working. But then there's this other aspect of my life, which I need too, because it just helps so much that I see that, hey, I went through a horrible thing, but maybe because of the work that I'm doing and that I'm convincing other people to do with me, maybe someone else won't have as bad a time. They're going to have a hard time, but maybe it's going to make enough change that it won't be as terrible. So, like, I'm really hyped up because those are two really great things. Acting is a good and noble profession. I don't think it's creepy unless you choose it to be creepy. I love acting. I love it. I love the theater. I love film. And then on the other hand, being able to help people and be a spokesperson. So I feel lucky.
Is there a chapter of Victims for Victims in Philadelphia?
Right. This is the thing. We're going to start a chapter in Philadelphia. Two people who are community members here, Greg McCready's, who was a crime victim prevented from going into the Olympics because of his victimization, a very serious victimization, is one of them. Tom McGurn, who wrote Woman's Bible of Survival in a Violent Society, who was also a Philadelphia person, not a victim, but very interested in helping. Those two men are instrumental in starting it, and we really need people to join. I'd like to give a phone number. There's going to be a meeting of Victims for Victims to begin a Philadelphia chapter. The meeting will be held next Saturday, November 17th, and we'd encourage people to attend. It'll probably be on a Saturday morning. And in order to get more information, please call 522-4646. That's 522-4646. And what we need, now right now we can't help people because we're not organized. What we need particularly are people who are good with organization, who can help us get this chapter off the ground. Because, and they don't have to be victims. Along the course of time now, Victims for Victims, the organization which helps crime victims, the membership is now 50-50. You can be a non-victim. If you're a professional, you have a service to donate. But particularly anyone who thinks they can help organize a chapter. This doesn't have to be a lifetime commitment. But we need people with skills like that, administration, organizing, making phone calls, making arrangements, things like that. So that's it.
Teresa, I know that you have a bodyguard who's accompanying you now. Do you think that you're still in danger, or that the movie and the violence depicted in the movie would endanger you?
Well, look, I can't say yes, I can't say no. I certainly am not going on the assumption that anyone would want to harm me, no. But the reason I have a bodyguard is not only because I was a victim, but because I'm in the media, and I'm a victim, and I'm active in victims' rights. So it's a very complicated issue. I'm always on television. I'm on public service announcements and radio and television a lot, in the print media, et cetera. So it's a little bit nervous-making for that reason. I wouldn't say that anyone who's ever been attacked needs to have a bodyguard from now on. No, nothing like that. It's just the combination of the issue, the political situation, things like that. It's a precaution. It's a precaution. And Greg's my friend. He's a nice guy. We enjoy each other. He's a companion and associate as much as a bodyguard. But he is 6'5", and he's a trained bodyguard. So it's good to have that security.
Speaking with Teresa Saldana, and you may remember her co-starring in the film Raging Bull, she stars in a movie about her own life that will be shown on NBC television this Monday night at 9 o'clock, and she's in Philadelphia appearing in the Walnut Street Theater Company production of Chekhov in Yalta. I'd like to talk to you about Raging Bull a little bit and your role in that. You were directed in that movie by Martin Scorsese. Did he give you a direction unlike the kind of direction you were used to before?
I was familiar with that kind of work, and that's partly why I was cast. It's a very improvisational, realistic, naturalistic way of working, and I don't always work like that because most people don't work that way, but I was trained by Sanford Meisner, and a lot of his technique is based on that kind of ability to improvise, ability to take reality, that kind of very gritty, homespun reality. And so working with Scorsese and De Niro was wonderful. It was just a thrill because they take so much time. They do so many takes. They discuss it. They rehearse it. And you don't stick rigidly to a script. It's based on human feelings, the way that life is. So it's a unique situation.
I know Robert De Niro gained about 40 pounds or more than that for the role. And his body's never looked quite the same since. Like, his body never looks like it did, for instance, in Taxi Driver. Did you ever talk to him about gaining all that weight for a role?
I didn't, because I worked for 6 weeks on the project, and he'd only gained a certain amount by that point, maybe 20 pounds, mm-hmm. Nothing dangerous. And I had no idea he was planning to do that. He was eating a lot. So it wasn't... And then by the time I saw him again, he'd lost most of it. I saw him pretty recently in New York, right before he started the movie with Ulu Grosbart. And he looked about the same. Maybe not as skinny, but he was definitely all the way down. I had seen him in another stage, maybe 20 pounds heavier. But no, I think in the new movie that he just did. I think he's going to look pretty slim. Mm-hmm. Took a while. I mean, that's a big stretch to put your body through.
Could you see yourself doing anything like that?
Not to that extreme, I don't think. I would gain weight for a role or lose weight for a role. I've done that before. But I think particularly a woman's body might fare less well mm-hmm. than a man's.
You're currently in Philadelphia performing in Chekhov and Yalta at the Walnut Street Theater. Can you give us an idea of what the play's about?
It's great. It's about the Moscow Art Theater. And it's about Anton Chekhov, the playwright, and Konstantin Stanislavsky, who headed up the theater as artistic director. And it's about all the other members of the theater paying Chekhov a visit at his Yalta estate. And it's really a comedy. It's a lot of fun. And I'm really enjoying hearing audiences laugh and cheer and have a lot of joy in something after all this drama that I've been doing lately. It's really fun. The audiences are absolutely loving it. It's a little bit serial comic, but I call it more comedy than anything. And it's a wacky kind of behind-the-scenes look at performers and people like that and the difference between tragedy and comedy. And it's just a lot of fun. And the actors in it are great. Catherine Cox, who's in Baby on Broadway, is in it. She's the leading lady. And Stephen Keep is Chekhov. And Mark Capri is Stanislavsky. Just a terrific cast. Everybody in the cast is great. John Connolly is Nemirovich. I wish I could mention everyone. There are 11 people in the cast. And it's an ensemble piece, very much. And I play Mrs. Stanislavsky, who is the ingenue and costume designer of the company. And she's neglected by her husband and very high strung. And she goes through a really nice transition within the play. She starts off just a nervous wreck, high strung, neglected wife, and kind of goes through a number of changes. And it's a delight to play comedy. When I do a punchline and hear that laughter, it's just terrific.
Well, you'll be performing that through Sunday.
Yeah, through November 18th.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a week from this Sunday.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And after that?
Well, I'm going to New York, actually, to help start a chapter in New York of Victims for Victims, possibly briefly. I've been offered a TV show in New York. I'm not sure if I can fit it in. I have to go to L.A. and go to a Victims for Victims meeting in L.A. So there's a lot of running around the television offer. I have to see if I can do it or not. A lot of things. Lisa and David, the musical, will hopefully be produced in New York, and a lot of things.
One last question about Victims for Victims. Does it prolong the period of recovery for you to constantly be in touch with people who have recently been victimized and are still going through the emotional trauma and physical trauma of it?
For most people, no. Some, yes. Some people, it's not the kind of thing they should be involved with. For most people, what it does is it shows you how far you've come, and it helps you to get even farther when you help somebody who's worse off. Could I give the address of Victims for Victims?
Sure.
Okay. If people would like to get in touch with the national chapter of Victims for Victims and talk about starting a chapter in their community or possibly donate, it is tax-exempt, a deductible contribution, please, 1800 South Robertson Boulevard, Building 6, Suite 400, L.A., 90035, and that's if you'd like to start a chapter in your community. There will be one in Philly. If you'd like to join the one in Philly, we need help. It's 522-4646.
Okay, listen, it's really been nice to meet you, and I want to thank you for doing the show today.
Thank you.